From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For most of us, our jobs, our relationships depend on being, quote unquote, normal. Normalcy is the security blanket of society. But what if you aren't normal? Do you wear your abnormality on your sleeve, thumbing your nose at those who define what is normal in society? Or do you strive to overcome or even suppress your abnormality and fit in? This hour, what is normal? We'll get some straight talk from a former March of Dimes poster child.
You serve as kind of a reflection for people's worst fears. So they look at a child with a disability and they think, oh, I'm going to give money to this organization so that that doesn't happen to my child. So what does that make the child who is being sort of presented on this pedestal?
And the Amish ritual of Rumspringen, where 16-year-olds are let loose to experience the temptations of the world with no rules, all with the hope that when they're done, they'll come back to the fold.
You've got almost no contact with the outside world. The Amish have no electricity, TV, radio. All you know is the Amish way of life. But the day you turn 16, your whole life changes.
You start dating.
Go shopping in malls.
Start dressing English.
Go to the movie theater.
Go bowling.
Watch TV.
Get a haircut.
Go to parties.
Get a car.
Go cruising.
Get drunk.
Sleep around.
Go at it.
But first, eavesdropping. It's the title of the memoir by Stephen Cusisto. He's blind, and he says the blind get to eavesdrop on the rest of us, mostly because we don't notice they're listening. Anne Strainchamp sat down with Cusisto and talked with him about why he wrote a memoir about listening.
It's a funny thing. I was talking to a group of newly blind people in Boston, Massachusetts, and I had just done a pretty good job of talking about going places all over the planet, really, with my first guide dog, whose name was Corky. And suddenly a woman in the back of the room said, well, why travel anywhere if you can't see? She was very depressed. She was probably early 60s, newly blind from diabetes. And I tried to answer the question in that assuring way that all of us who make our living by words often do. You know, I said, well, there's great music in Venice and good bratwursts in Milwaukee and all kinds of reasons to travel when you can't see, but I realized I wasn't answering her question because the question really had to do with neurology, in a sense, the aesthetics that come from having a neurologically wired brain. We all are wired, even the blind, to have pleasure centers in our cortex that are directly connected to the optic nerves. And to imagine rerouting your brain to use an alternative set of senses to replace the beauty of seeing with something else. What would, you know, how would you do that, really? I mean, we talk about it all the time, right? We say, oh, the blind must have such better hearing than the sighted. You must be able to hear a mouse 8 miles away and, you know, all of that stuff, right? We do that all the time. But in point of fact, the blind statistically have no better hearing than anyone else. And if we train ourselves to hear better, what does it mean exactly? And in aesthetic terms, what does it mean?
So one of the themes that's really woven through this book that you wrote is the difference between hearing and listening. And it's also very much your own personal story of learning to, I suppose the way you just described it, kind of connect the pleasure centers in the brain with your sense of hearing. So there's some wonderful stories about the first and most intense memories you have of sound. For instance, some of the earliest scenes are you're in Finland, right, with your parents?
Yeah, the book opens in Helsinki, Finland in 1959, and I'm standing on a dock in the harbor at the end of winter with my father, and he's describing to me his blind child, right? He's describing the different shapes and patterns suggested by ice as it's melting. Old women, even today, will go down to the harbor and beat their carpets. They hang their carpets on racks that stand beside the sea, and they beat their carpets with big whisks, and they sing. And these old women came down to the harbor and began singing old folk songs, you know. And my dad said, listen, these are the old songs. And it's one of my earliest memories of these, you know, dour, severe, really essentially ancient sort of archetypal women singing dark folk songs down by the Finnish seashore.
Oi tara, ai tara, liinat huivit liottamma.
Maybe it was a Saturday. I remember that my parents were still sleeping. I had a plan and dressed quietly. When I was certain that no one was awake, I slipped from the house. I loved to walk in the woods and follow the beams of light or depths of shade that fell between trees. I remember that on this particular day, I got lost while chasing light and found myself standing in front of the university's horse barn. I knew that somewhere in the cool space before me, a horse was breathing. I stood in the door and listened to him breathe. He sounded like water going down a drain. Then I took one step forward into a pyramid of fragrances. Who would guess that horses sometimes hold their breath? The horse was eyeing me from his corner. Then two cats were talking. Wind pushed forcefully at the high roof. Somewhere up high, a timber groaned. My horse was still holding his breath. When would he breathe again? Come on, boy, breathe for me. Where are you? I heard him rub his flank against a wall. Then I heard him breathe again with a great deflation. He sounded like a fat balloon venting in circles. And then I imitated him with my arm pressed to my mouth. I made great flatulent noises by pressing my lips to my forearm. How do you like that, horse? He snorted. I noticed the ringing of silence. An insect traveled between our bursts of forced air. Sunlight warmed my face. I was standing in a wide sunbeam. I was in the luminous whereabouts of horse. Judging by his breathing, his slow release of air, his sound of a concertina, judging by this, I was nearly beside him. And so I reached out, and there was the great wet fruit of his nose, the velvet bone of his enormous face. And we stood there together for a little while, all alive and all alone. At night, when I couldn't sleep, I thought of this horse. I thought of his glory, his fat sound. I thought of how he pinched the air around him with his breathing. The house and the trees swayed in the night wind. The horse was dry wood talking. He was all nerves and nostrils. He tightened and then unwound, like a clock. He groaned, like the Finnish women who stood beside the ocean, waving their sticks, strophe and anti-strophe, step, rhythm, pulse beat. I'd crossed a threshold, hearing and walking. The uncertain space that opened before me.
Oi tara, ai tara, päivä pari kuiva. Päivä kuivatettu, päivä on kuivatettu. Pyykit pyöritetty, pyykit on pyöritetty. Liinat liotettu, liinat on liotettu. Suopa silotettu, suopa on silotettu. Vesi valutettu, vesi on valutettu. Vesi valutettu. Vesi on valutettuna ja liinat on liotettuna.
So we've talked about some of your earliest memories of sound. One of the other kinds of early memories you have are memories of not just the ambient noise of the world around you, but organized sound, music. Those are some especially intense passages. I have the impression music very early on hit you with just such power.
It's really true, and one dynamic of that continues to be an ongoing fascination for me with the work and career and the old vintage records of Enrico Caruso, the great opera singer.
What do you like so much about Caruso?
Well, One thing is that I discovered Caruso while alone. I wasn't playing baseball. I wasn't part of organized sports. I was free to sort of wander around in the dusty places, right? And one summer, I found myself in my grandmother's great old Victorian house in the attic where there was a wind-up Victrola. And, you know, you're probably familiar with those, that big bell-shaped horn and the big heavy tone arm with the needle in it, and the record was on there, sitting on the platter, as it had been since somebody carted it up to the attic some probably 20 years earlier. This would have been 1960, so it had been up there a while. And, you know, I found out that this thing made spectacular sound, right? That you could wind it up, put the needle in that groove, and there was a recording of Caruso singing from Pagliacci, right? The famous aria Vesti la Giubba, where the clown Canio is lamenting that he has been cuckolded by his wife. And, you know, it's one of the great arias of bel canto opera. And, of course, it's an old Victrola record, right? So it's full of scratches and pops and this voice coming out of the horn on a Victrola.
Was
so
it
there
scary,
I was alone
the
in this...
first time you heard it?
Oh, fantastically scary. And, you know, I mean, you just have to picture this, right? It's Recitar mon prester It's amazing, discordant, scratchy, groaning noises coming out of this odd bell-shaped device in this attic that's full of pigeons, you know, and I'm up there all alone. And then, of course, because this is a dramatic moment in the opera, Caruso as Canio, the clown, who will eventually murder his wife in the opera, right, laughs bitterly, and it comes out of the Victrola's horn like this. Is... I had to run. I fled. I ran from the room, you know.
Stephen, if an operation could give you 20/20 vision tomorrow, would you do it?
You know, it's interesting. In disability culture, people are divided around that kind of question. Some people say that if they could have a medical procedure done and thereby eliminate their disability, they would choose not to do that, that they've grown comfortable with their disabled persona, the disabled self. And more to the point, why should they have to, right? That the disabled self is no less important or valuable or meaningful in the great public tapestry than any other condition or point of origin. So there's a point of pride to disability that you don't have to do that. On the other hand, there are people, and I count myself in this category, who I think probably would, only because, you know, I think I would like to buy a motorcycle and go ripping down a Midwestern road in the middle of summer. There are things I would like to do that I think, you know, the experience of vision would be pretty amazingly about. And so I think I would. I think I would.
Stephen Cosisto is the author of Eavesdropping, a memoir of blindness and listening. And Strangechamp spoke with him. And here's Cosisto reading his poem called Elegy for Ray Charles and His Mother. It was written on the day of Ray Charles' death.
Ray, no one knows what it's like to carry water the way your mother made you carry it. Even the boy Pharaoh wore a yoke on his shoulders just to show he was a man. History doesn't matter much, at least until your child done gone blind. You always got to carry water. That's what your mother said. This ain't no kidding around. Long time, you carried water in both hands, feeling for the path with your feet. Ray, your mama knew. A song comes that way, or else it never will. Laugh or cry, it's the same. A mockingbird listens from a telephone wire. Long time. Water. Both hands.
Now don't put all your dreams in one basket. Best made plans may go astray. If you play for high stakes, you might play with heartaches. Never throw your dreams away. Never throw your dreams away.
What is normal? What's not? Why not send us an email through our website at ttbook.org? Later this hour, a former March of Dimes poster child.
No matter what I do, no matter how hard I try, no matter how many A's I get or, you know, scholarships I win, I will always have an artificial leg. And I really didn't like that answer.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Emily Rapp was born with a birth defect that required she have her foot amputated when she was 4. Then at age 8, after dozens of operations, she lost the rest of her leg. It was during this time she became the poster child for the March of Dimes. Always perky, always smiling, she gave pep talks and cut ribbons, her red hair in pigtails, her freckles juxtaposed with her wooden leg. Emily Rapp chronicles her experiences with, as she puts it, my grievous, irrevocable flaw, in her memoir called Poster Child. Anne Strainchamps asked Emily what the first memory of her body was.
That's a good question. My first memory of my body is probably being immobile in a hospital bed and seeing a nightlight on in the hallway and lots of nurses. And I do vividly remember being in a body cast and how that felt.
How did it feel?
Itchy. And smelly. It was very smelly. And sort of this idea that, very conscious of it, I guess. So early on, I was very self-conscious of the body. And then I think after that, I just, you know, it just was. And I also remember when I had my first leg, which was wooden, the relief of taking it off at night and sort of feeling like I had two bodies, the one that I wore the leg with and the one that I sort of hopped around without at night. And I remember just feeling really free at that time. Whenever I would take it off at night, it was kind of a relief.
That memory of the one of the first operations, the first big operation happened when you were 4, right? When
yes,
your foot
that's
was
right.
amputated?
Yeah, that was the first big one. I had, it's so funny because I just read a book about this and I'm like, now how did that go? I had another one right before that was sort of a prep operation, a hip operation. And then I had the amputation when I was 4. And I do have some memories of that. But again, it's hard to know how much of it is a story that was told to me and how much of it is a vivid memory.
Do you remember missing your foot?
I do remember that. I remember the phantom limb pains, and I remember being confused. I remember that they showed me the doll, and they were like, you know, your foot's going to go away. And I was just like, what? It's a doll without a one leg. What's up? You know? So, yeah, I do remember that. But, you know, they're not the funny thing is that they're not sad memories so much. They're just,
really?
No.
Because they sound heartbreaking to
yeah.
adults hearing them now.
I think to adults, but I think that, you know, when you're a child, you have the body that you have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So whatever shape it takes, whatever it is, it is. At that time, you're not aware of sort of what bodies are good and what bodies are bad. It's just that people are people, mm-hmm. which is one of the gifts of childhood that we're, you know, all constantly trying to recover as adults, I think. So I think at the time I was just like, oh, here it is, you know, and my parents were like, this is what it is and we're going to deal with it. And fortunately, I had parents that sort of let me be who I was. And even if that meant, you know, scarring up the leg and like tripping over things and having incidents, they were just like, yeah, you want to go roller skating? Great, go ahead. You know,
and this was around the time you became the title of your book, Poster Child. You
six,
became the poster
six,
child
that's
for
right.
March of Dimes.
At six. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So. And, well, what do you remember about that time?
I remember feeling like a diva. It was awesome. You know, people were coming to my house and they were taking pictures and it was all about me. And, you know, I got to go, you know, I would go and cut ribbons at the opening of a new hardware store or something really small town. And, the people from the local newspaper would be there.
The way you describe it in the book, there's sort of a shadow side to this.
Absolutely.
The way you describe it in the book is mm-hmm. that's sort of the beginning of when you began to need to be special.
Exactly. Well, the flip side, or the, as you say, the shadow side of the whole poster child phenomena is that, you know, poster children, which there aren't anymore. It's now called ambassador families by the March of Dimes. So I mm-hmm. think they've sort of revisited what that means. But you serve as kind of a reflection for people's worst fears. So they look at a child with a disability and they think, oh, I'm going to give money to this organization so that that doesn't happen to my child. So what does that make the child who is being sort of presented on this pedestal? It's problematic for obvious reasons. But I think that's the role that disabled people have often played in society, is that people think, well, thank God I don't have a disability. And they think, oh, you know, there's a pity and revulsion combination. When the reality is that all of us will have disabilities before we die. In some mm-hmm. way or another. So the idea that there's a category of us and them is an arbitrary thing meant to sustain people's illusions about health and well-being and, you know, that they have control over their bodies. And people with disabilities know that that's actually not true. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's a gift. You know, I guess I'll age better. Because I know, I'll know that, you know,
you've already come to terms
the body
with
is a fallible
that it takes
thing.
Other people.
Yeah. And in this culture, especially American culture, where, you know, there's, especially for women, there's this idea that you should control your body. And your happiness sort of rests on how much you can control your body and how it looks and that kind of thing. And so I think a lot of women do identify with that part of my book, this perfection illusion, mm-hmm. the quest for perfection, which is a ridiculous quest and pointless, but yet we do it. So, mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking that there's this, you know, this tension in your story. On the one hand, this powerful drive to say, I can do anything.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You know, that I can swim, I can jump, I can mm-hmm. ride a bike, I can roller skate, I can ski, I can achieve, I can go to college, I can do
yeah.
anything.
Yes. But who can do anything? Like, that's the irony, is that I think people with disabilities, in their quest to overcompensate, say, well, I'm just like you. In order to be normal, you have to be, like, super normal. And there's a term for that in the disabled community called super crip, like mm-hmm. the super cripple, the super gimp. And the idea is that if by being so great, you approximate a level of normalness that other people just have as a result of having a whole, quote, body.
Is that what you set out to be?
I think I probably did. And of course, then I was like, this isn't going to work, because no matter what I do, no matter how hard I try, no matter how many A's I get or, you know, scholarships I win, I will always have an artificial leg. And I really didn't like that answer. When I came to that conclusion, I was just really unhappy with it. And so then, you know, when I was in Korea, when I came to that conclusion, ultimately, I had to sort of say, you know, I'm 21 now and I better get a grip on this, or some of the patterns that I'm setting now will continue down a road that is dark and self-loathing, and I don't want to go there.
How did you feel about the leg itself?
I hated it. I mean, I never wore, like, short skirts or shorts, or I just didn't. I just didn't like to look at it. And sometimes I would, you know, look at myself in the mirror, and, like, what I saw in the mirror didn't match the way I sort of saw myself. Because, like, most people with disabilities, it's like, it's a part of my identity, and of course in this book it's, like, paramount, but on a day-to-day basis now, it's just, like, whatever, you get on with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really, and it was a pretty clunky wooden sort of basic leg at that time. So I was just like, you know, just wanted to get it off. And now I have more fondness for it, and I've tried to sort of understand that it's part of my body and, you know, trying to do all that kind of work around it. But it is interesting. It's interesting to be reliant on something external to you and absolutely need it, but then also resent it at the same time.
Emily Rapp's memoir is called Poster Child. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. Emily Rapp's struggles with her own body, though extreme, are not uncommon for teenage girls. Having a flawed body, who doesn't? In a society where flawless women's bodies are valued above almost everything else, is part of the coming-of-age ritual for American girls today. Essayist Harriet Brown discovered this firsthand with her teenage daughter.
The spring my oldest daughter turned 14, my husband and I were ready for trouble. 14, we'd been told, is the age when the child you know disappears behind slammed doors and a curtain of hair. If you're lucky, she reemerges some months later, and you congratulate yourselves for having survived the worst year of your parenting lives. The trouble came, all right, though not in the form we expected. It started in the kitchen. Each night when I started cooking, my daughter was right there, lifting pot lids, adding salt, and generally being underfoot. She was full of opinions and comments, and she never wanted to eat what I was cooking. I thought this obsession with culinary arts might be a symbol of her growing autonomy, odd but sort of understandable, youth challenging age in the inevitable evolutionary showdown. None of my friends' teenagers had displayed an unnatural interest in cooking, but so what? Maybe this represented a new impulse toward closeness on her part. After all, I'd been trying to get her to cook with me since she was 5 years old. Perhaps this marked a new stage of intimacy between us. Except it didn't feel intimate. I felt annoyed, then put upon. I started grocery shopping at midnight so I wouldn't have to negotiate each and every item in the cart, and found myself cooking as much as possible when she wasn't home. The kitchen obsession was quickly followed by other odd behaviors. She called from a sleepover at 1 a.m., begging to come home. She began crying, daily and copiously. She wanted to be with me all the time. Part of me was flattered. My teenage daughter wasn't rejecting me. I must be a wonderful mother. Part of me was worried. Shouldn't she be rejecting me? On Mother's Day, we took a family bike ride and had to stop for an hour while she wept uncontrollably. That night, my husband and I sat up talking. Remember being 14? We asked each other. Teenage hormones. Wouldn't live through it again for $1 million. Our daughter, we agreed, had to go through her share of teenage angst just like everybody else. There was no free pass on adolescence. We'd revisit the issue in a month. But by then, we knew what we were dealing with, and it wasn't normal adolescence. An obsession with food and cooking, increased anxiety and depression, clinginess, all these were early symptoms of anorexia. The last to appear was weight loss. Within weeks, my daughter was in the hospital, emaciated, terrified, clearly in the grip of something bigger and more dangerous than I could have imagined. A month earlier, I'd felt irritated with her. Now I woke each morning hoping she'd live through the day. My husband and I got a crash course in eating disorders. We embarked on a long, emotionally fraught year of treatment and recovery, which so far has turned out well. Today my daughter is a healthy, reasonably happy 16-year-old. People have asked us how we missed those early warning signs. How could we not have known? And in hindsight, it's all quite clear. But what parent hasn't worried about a child's behavior? Who among us can identify the precise moment that normal behavior, whatever that is, becomes pathological? Human beings rarely conform to textbook descriptions. And so I resist, as much as possible, the temptation to lie awake and castigate myself for not having picked up on my daughter's illness more quickly. I don't always succeed.
Harriet Brown's a writer and lives in Madison, Wisconsin. What is normal? What's not? Why not send us an email through our website at ttbook.org? Coming up, the Amish ritual of Rumspringa, where 16-year-old Amish are let loose in the world with no rules.
For most kids, Rumspringa means going out and getting wasted. Then you have a hangover and go back and join church. It's like a vaccination. You get a little dose of the outside world, just enough so you won't get tempted later on. And you'll be a happier Amish person if you had a choice.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. The Amish are unique in many ways. No electricity, no radio, no cars, only horse and buggy. You'd think being an Amish 16-year-old would be a drag, to say the least. But the opposite is true. At age 16, Amish teens are let loose with no rules to experience all the temptations of the world. This coming-of-age ritual is called Rumspringa. Tom Schachtman's the author of the book Rumspringa, To Be or Not to Be Amish. He says you have to understand a little about Amish theology to fully understand the idea behind Rumspringa.
The Amish are Anabaptists. That means they believe only in adult baptism. To be baptized, you have to be an adult, you have to be knowledgeable about the world, and you have to be repentant. And those three things sort of mandate that you have a period of time in which to discover how to be an adult, how to learn about the world, and to have something to repent about and understand that you need repentance. So that's the sort of technical reason why for Rumspringa. There are sociological reasons, too, which is that kids who've been raised in this fairly strict environment have a sort of a built-up tension in them, a sense of, I need to get out and take a look at the world. I may eventually decide to come back into the Amish world and stay here for the rest of my life, but I really need to see what's on the other side, whether the grass is greener or not.
When you grow up Amish, you're taught that God is the most important thing in your life. Right after God come your parents, and you're supposed to obey them in everything they say. You've got almost no contact with the outside world. The Amish have no electricity, TV, radio. All you know is the Amish way of life. But the day you turn 16, your whole life changes.
You start dating.
Go shopping in malls.
Start dressing English.
Go to the movie theater.
Go bowling.
Watch TV.
Get a haircut.
Go to parties.
Get a car.
Go cruising.
Get drunk.
Sleep around.
No edit.
Mainstream teenagers, English teenagers, at 16, even those who have lived in the world for 16 years, I think everybody agrees, have trouble handling the increased freedom that they get. Total freedom, as you describe it for the Amish families. It sounds as though the invitation to go off the deep end is almost too much.
I think it's a great risk, both for the teenagers and for the parents. The parents have to think to themselves, I've got to let my child do this, because if they don't do this, they'll never get it out of their system, and they probably won't come back. If I do allow them to go out and do whatever it is they're going to do, pretty soon they'll see that the Amish way of life is the best, and they'll come back, and then they'll be better Amish than they would have been if they just harbored this sort of sense that they'd never been outside and the grass was greener on the other side of the fence. As for the children, they certainly do go off the deep end sometimes because they've had no training. They don't know very much about the world. They don't know very much about how kids interact with one another as a semi-adult. They don't know how people in the they assume that everybody in the outside world may be as honest as the people they've lived with all of their lives. Everything is a sort of a gee whiz experience to them. And this is neither good nor bad. It's just what is. Most of the Amish kids make the most of their time in their own terms. In my terms, I think they don't make a heck of a lot of the time. Yeah. I mean, they don't go and do really wild things. They don't climb mountains in Tibet. They don't go to Chicago and take art classes. They don't run off to Mexico and try the mushrooms. I mean, these are not things that they do because they have not got any experience. They might go to the mall, but not much further.
My clothes was the biggest thing. That was the hardest thing to change when I was... church.
I did run a lot every day after work. Just put on shorts and t-shirt and go running, which now I don't do that because running in a dress.
I miss my music, you know, that I grew up with.
One of my favorite times was when I was at like Ozfest 99 and Godsmack and all those concerts. I love concerts.
The first probably 3 or 4 years after we was married and joined a church, I thought for a while I just couldn't make it, but oh well, I got used to it. It's not that bad anymore.
You say that though 80 to 90% of the kids do come back, they decide to be baptized, so Rumspringa works.
Yes, that's as much as the sociologists have been able to find out. When their questionnaires and other ways of looking at statistics around the country, upwards of 80% of the kids do come back, which suggests objectively that this Rumspringa process works if we consider working to be returning people to the fold.
There's some fascinating questions that come out of this, though. I mean, if that's true, if 80 to 90%, then maybe this isn't so freeing after all. There must be incredible pressure on the kids to come back if they know that almost everybody does.
There is tremendous pressure. There's also pressure because of what they're not able to do out there. After all, these kids are going out there with very little education, certainly not enough to hold many of the jobs that are available in society today, which are generally restricted to people who have high school degrees and above. They have no capital. They're not going to be able to start big businesses or even small ones. They have very little knowledge of the world, so they don't know that if they go to Chicago and sign up for a bulletin board, they might be able to find a job or they might be able to find a roommate or something like that. There's lots of knowledge that they don't have. And this is, in a sense, a self-restriction on what it is that they're capable of doing during the Rumspringa period.
So it suggests that the system is set up to get them to come back in some way.
Oh, it's a fairly stacked deck, I would say. And I've argued with some of the Amish elders about some aspects of this, particularly the education thing, because the Amish kids are taken out of school at 14 or 15. If they're in an Amish school, it may be around 15. If they're in a public school, it's after eighth grade, which means they're not getting a high school education at all because they don't really want people questioning the faith. And if you start to question, you know, whether Shakespeare wrote the sonnets, you may be next questioning whether the Bible is true.
Deep-seated within you is the idea that I am Amish and I will be Amish. Your parents and your community, your church, has become such a part of you. And the thought that you are different from the people around you is so deep-seated. It might never leave you.
We've talked about this as though it is the same for everyone, but of course it is not the way you describe it. It is one thing for boys to run out and be wild and another for girls. Yes, they're allowed to, but the girls generally go out, I gather, in their Amish dress, and should they fall too far from the tree, they would have more trouble coming back, perhaps, than the boys.
Well, there's no trouble coming back. Anytime you want to, you can come back, except if you've been baptized and then left the church. That's a little dicier. But the Amish are very big on forgiveness, and the rest of us learned this after the Nickel Mines tragedy, when most of the world was rather stunned at how forgiving the Amish were towards the killer and the killer's family. And those of us who'd had the pleasure of studying the Amish were not really that amazed, because we understood this to be a very basic tenet of the Amish faith. So if you have a daughter who has, quote, fallen, unquote, who's out there and comes back pregnant, the child will be born within the community and will be cared for within the community.
I wish I could say that I have never opened a can of beer. You know, that'd be great. I wish I could say that, but I can't. Every time there was a party, I was there and I was drunk. I was just hanging out with anybody I wanted to, going out with any guy I wanted to. Who cares?
I did things I wish I wouldn't have done. I didn't dress Amish. I went to a Baptist church. I didn't live at home for 5 months. For a girl, that's almost unthinkable.
People started talking to me. My parents started talking to me. And they're like, you know, we really don't like what you're doing. But they didn't say, you have to change. I finally just said, you know, I can't do this anymore. So I'm changing.
There is something to be gained from learning about this Rumspringa, because it tells us much more about ourselves, about what it is that we need to do with and for our children in the world. How are they to gain the necessary experience to grow into responsible adults? How much experience is enough? how little experience is not enough. I mean, what is our responsibility as parents for introducing our children to the world, and how should we do that? All of these things have echoes in Rumspringa.
For most kids, Rumspringa means going out and getting wasted. Then you have a hangover and go back and join church. It's like a vaccination. You get a little dose of the outside world, just enough so you won't get tempted later on. And you'll be a happier Amish person if you had a choice.
Tom Shackman's the author of Rumspringa, To Be or Not to Be Amish. The book's based in part on Shackman's research for the documentary The Devil's Playground, from which we heard clips. This hour, we're talking about what is normal. And there's nothing more normal than sleeping. Just ask an insomniac.
How long should it take me to fall asleep, ideally?
Most people fall asleep in 15 minutes or less.
And what should be going through my mind when my head hits the pillow?
That you love the way that pillow feels. That you love the way that bed feels. That you've never felt more comfortable in your life. And the next thing is nothing. You just lie there, enjoying how wonderful it feels just to be in this bed.
That sounds like science fiction.
No, that's, but you asked me what you should feel. That's it. If every night, night after night after night, you don't sleep well, then what happens is the bedroom itself, the sleeping environment, the whole idea of sleep,
for me, becomes a battlefield.
That's Alan Berliner from his HBO documentary, Wide Awake. He is a chronic insomniac who goes days without sleeping. And when he does sleep, it's only for a few fitful hours. Alan Berliner told Steve Paulson he's had trouble sleeping for as long as he can remember.
It's been a problem that's followed me since early childhood. I can remember lying in bed as a 7, 8, 9-year-old little boy, watching the shadows and the lights of cars going through the Venetian blinds and making rather beautiful, I might add, designs and patterns on my ceiling, on the ceiling of my bedroom. So the idea of being awake at night when everyone else was sleeping, and especially at that time when I had school the next day and I knew I was going to pay for it, is something that's been around for a long time. And I've learned to cope with it. I've learned to reckon with it. I've learned to accept it. But of course, I have struggled with it ever since.
Yeah. Now, I understand what you're saying because I've had insomnia at various points in my life. And I guess what I have found most maddening is that there can be times when I am really exhausted. I get into bed and then suddenly it's like my mind lights up.
Yeah.
And all of my problems and troubles and worries start racing through my head and they seem to be much worse than they were during the day. Does that happen to you?
That's the classic pattern. You know, there's no causality. I used to think, okay, I barely slept on Monday, so Tuesday I'm obviously going to get a good night's sleep. And then there I am in bed on Tuesday, you know, wired. And then, okay, now it's Wednesday night. And of course, I haven't slept Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, I'm just going to crash, of course. Nope.
So it sounds like you must be tired all the time.
Well, I am tired a lot. But still, you know, I've been diagnosed with something called delayed sleep phase syndrome. And it's just an acknowledgement that my biological clock is set differently than most people. And, you know, I don't get tired until very, very late in the morning. It also means that in the various sort of qualitative ways of measuring performance and alertness and general aptitudes, I am sharper, more alert, able to do things. I'm just better at night. So the morning is tough for me. Even this very interview that we're doing. I mean, if we did this, say, 12 hours from now, in the middle of the evening, it'd be a totally different interview. You know, I'd be in a different place. The morning for me, generally speaking, is when I do very light lifting. It's a time for just filling out forms and putting stamps on envelopes.
So have you tried various things, maybe tricks or certain sleep techniques to try to solve this problem?
Over the years, I've tried virtually everything. I've been hypnotized. I've tried valerian root, very hot baths, warm milk. You know, I tried drinking myself to sleep. was a time in my life when I thought I've had a lot of sex before I went to sleep. That would help. It did a little, actually.
What about sleeping pills? How helpful are they?
Well, you know, the new sleeping pills, and it's a booming industry now, are not, so to speak, our grandparents' sleeping pills. They're not barbiturates, you know, and they're not antihistamines. They are very specifically targeted to go towards areas in the brain that are, you know, thought centers. They're actually quelling the brain. They're putting the brain to sleep, actually. They're not making us tired. They're actually taking that center of rumination and taking that center of focus that won't let go, you know, the part of consciousness that won't let go. And they're targeting that center of the brain. And sleeping pills have changed my life, just even knowing that they're there. I would never travel, for instance, anymore without a sleeping pill. Mm-hmm. It's my safety net when I go anywhere around the world. And it has actually been a godsend, a blessing for me. But, you know, I take the sleeping pill judiciously.
All right, because you're not supposed to take it all the time. I mean,
that's
you
correct.
Know, you read the label on the bottle and, you know,
that's
you're
right.
supposed to take it for just a few days or so.
That's right. That's right.
Now, in your film, you talked to a bunch of doctors about your insomnia. What did they tell you?
Well, they told me a lot of things. I learned a lot from the doctors. Just for the record, the number one rule of sleep hygiene is to wake up at the same time every day, regardless of how much sleep you've had. That's the number one rule. 1A is to go to sleep at the same time. And so what they're really telling you is if you want to be a good sleeper, you should have, to some extent, a regular routine. And if you wake up, for instance, at different times every day, you are throwing yourself in a kind of artificial jet lag because you're, by not regulating the boundaries of your sleep, you're bouncing around and your biological clock can't find a balance, you know. Anyway, that's one thing about time of waking up and time of falling asleep. The other thing that I don't do, and I think many, many people don't do this as well, is that you're supposed to create a kind of time for decompression. My whole life I've worked and read and thought and just been doing things.
So decompression right is not exactly in,
the right
in
word.
Your life schedule.
No. I work right up until the moment that I go to sleep. And in fact, what's worse is that there's always a pad on my bed with several pens nearby. And I bring, not only when I shut the light from whatever I've been reading or working on, what have you, I bring, and now I'm brushing my teeth and I'm still thinking about it. And I'm flossing my teeth and I'm still thinking about it. And I wash my face, I'm still thinking about it. And then I get into bed and, well, now I'm thinking about it, but I'm just lying down. You know, and there's that pad. And the truth is, and oh, that's good. I'll write that down. And the fantastic thing is I wake up the next morning and I have 5 or 6 sheets rolled over, you know, on the pad. And I have barely a memory of what I wrote. But there they are, all this, you know, even if I bat, you know, 500, you know, half of them are things that are worthy of remembering or enacting the next day in terms of what I was working on. And that is not a good thing to do if you want to be a good sleeper.
Right. But on the other hand, I mean, what you're really saying is this is creatively a very fertile time for you. And I mean, you're a creative artist, you're a filmmaker. And so, you know, it raises some rather large questions about, you know, what if you were a better sleeper? Would your creativity start to dry up?
That, my friend, is the big quandary of my life that I explore through my film Wide Awake. It's a big question. My sleep or lack of it, the way I've coped with it, the way that I gravitate towards the night, the way that the night is my haven for my creative passion and for my sense of myself, that I feel if there's anything I need to do that's really important, you know, I wait till the midnight shift comes on. That's just the way it is. And, you know, that's, at this stage of the game, that's really hard to give up. At this stage of the game, it's who I am. You know, there's a little riff in my film where one of the doctors, Dr. Richard Simon, based out of Walla Walla, Washington, who is a musician himself, starts talking about Charlie Parker. And he says that Charlie Parker was a great musician. Of course, we're acknowledging he was also a heroin addict, but he was also a notorious insomniac. And he said to me, making a general statement, but he said in the case of Charlie Parker, whose work he admires very much, he said, you know, if he had been a better sleeper, he would have been 10 times the musician he was. And on some level, you know, maybe there's truth to that. But at the same time, Charlie Parker, who sleeps well, is living a different life, a different lifestyle, has a different identity, is overcoming a different equation in his life, and might not be the same musician. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when it's woven into the fabric of one's consciousness and identity, perhaps even DNA, what have you, it's a difficult question.
There's almost a philosophical question here, which is, I mean, essentially you're saying that your identity is built on this abnormal behavior. I mean, you're up in the middle of the night when, you know, 90% of everyone else, probably more, is asleep. But that's who you are, and it almost sounds like you need to embrace that to be able to do what you want to do.
There are times when I'm up in the middle of the night and I look out the window and I see all the, you know, all the buildings are dark and all the, you know, there are no lights on in any of the buildings, and I know that I'm the only person up in the building in which I live, and I know that, you know, everyone I know, virtually everyone I know, is sleeping. There's a sense, I think, that many artists have that who work at night, that we're kind of like the sentries. You know, someone has to look out over the bow on the ship while we're passing through the night. And we're sort of protecting things. There's sort of a protective quality of it. There's a sense of being a watchful eye, but there's also a sense of taking in the energy and the power of the night that someone has to do that feeds us and that's really important. And we mediate this energy and we synthesize it and, you know, we bring it back into the world of daylight, you know, the next day. We might be groggy when we do so, but there's a role to that. There's a place for that. And that it's, you know, despite the sacrifices, it's okay. You know, it's okay.
Alan Berliner is the director of the HBO documentary called Wide Awake. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for What is Normal? Program number 617A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strange Champs, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.